Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Excited to be here with you this Wednesday morning, April 9th. All kinds of fun things happening in the old Pueblo. Sorry I missed you guys last week. A big shout out to Alan Kate for covering me on The Morning Voice. I happen to have the opportunity to travel to Washington, D.C. and meet with a number of our electeds over there. Get a chance to see the White House during Liberation Day with a number of tariffs dropped over there. So quite a bit of political tension in Washington, D.C., but a trip that gives me appreciation every year for our civic process, right? And that exists both nationally and, of course, here in the old Pueblo as well, too. Now, on The Morning Voice, we love to talk about all things local. And, of course, we had city council meetings last night where they brought up a number of topics of local interest to us, and one of which that strikes of great interest to me as someone that's got a number of restaurants and residences in unincorporated Pima County is the differential water rates. Now, you may remember differential water rates from 2021. The city had this plan years ago to try to charge people in unincorporated Pima County about 7 to 10% more for their water. There were lawsuits over this particular plan. And the city ultimately was defeated by county lawsuits, and this created quite a schism between city and county governments, quite frankly. Governments that are often in lockstep, both controlled right now by the Democrat Party, but this happens to be a little bit of a schism over there. Certain Democrats, think Rex Scott, right, from District 1, is not going to stand idle while his constituents pay more money for water services, something that the city of Tucson had agreed to years ago when running its own water utility. The city lost this particular lawsuit because they didn't have any quantifiable proof about why delivering water to residents further out in the unincorporated counties, like how much it would cost more. So what did they do? The same city that has no money, the same city that has a budget deficit, right, that just asked you to pay an extra 0.5% in sales taxes, had enough money suddenly to find to do a study to make sure that they had the quantifiable evidence to go back to the table to charge Pima County residences more money for this water. And so this is going to come up in local politics over just the next few weeks over here and be a really big deal. We're going to keep an eye on this one on The Morning Voice, and I suggest you do as well too. Because water is a resource that is, of course, finite for us here in the desert, and this is going to continue to be an issue over and over again. Now, when we get into the city finances as well, too, the topic came up last night of free transit. Another topic that's had everybody's blood boiling over these last couple of years. For those that are not in the know, since basically COVID, mid-2020, the transit has been free in the city of Tucson. We haven't charged for buses. We haven't charged for the Sunlink streetcar. And of course, this contributes to the deficit budget that the city is currently running. How much does it really cost to run a bus system, a public transit system? I've seen estimates anywhere between $58 and $70 million. Now, the fares never fully paid for all of the cost of this transit. The municipality bears that burden as a public service, and that's understandable. Most municipalities do that. The fares were estimated to be anywhere between $11 and $13 million that we would get in fares. And those fares were about $1.50 a ride back in 2018, some of the last times that we were charging for these fares. So we were never going to get all the money back. But gosh, when things are free, it has no value to anybody. I liken this a lot to the restaurant industry. And I know I always lean back on restaurants. I'm your restaurant guy over here. But let's do a little analogy and think about when things are free, how people don't value this as much, right? In restaurants in years past, you would get a free drop at your table. There might be a delicious loaf of bread. Perhaps it was chips and salsa. Many Mexican restaurants had various types of botanitas that they would put tableside for you. And the guest always enjoyed this, right? Who doesn't love free bread or free chips and salsa? But you knew somewhere in the back of your mind, and I knew, that those things weren't really free. There was a cost to that. It was just baked in to everything else. It was built into the cost of your cerveza. It was built into the cost of your iced tea, or it was built into the cost of your plate of carne asada in some capacity. You were paying for this. And in fact, when all of these things are free forever, There's a number of guests that will abuse the system as well, too. And I don't say this disrespectfully. I love all of our guests. But we would end up dropping, in my early years, loaf after loaf of free bread, basket after basket of free chips and salsa, like topping them off, almost like how we would top off somebody's water. And suddenly this became a huge cost item. We were producing way more bread than we would have if the loaves had even cost 50 cents or a dollar, even if it was less than my cost to produce it. If it even had a cost of 1 cent, certain guests would say, no, thank you on that second pass or that third pass. But when it's free, why would you say, no, thank you? Bring it on. Let's go. And suddenly we're producing way, way more food than we need to. And at the end of the night, you know what we were doing? Throwing away full baskets of bread and throwing away full baskets of chips and salsa over and over again, right? And one of the most wasteful things that I have ever seen in the restaurant business. And over the years, as labor costs increased, the free drops have tightened up in the world, and you see less and less of this in the restaurant world. And so getting back to the bus, when something like this is 100% free, you've got complete and total abuse, right? Ridership that jumps on this for no other reason than to hang out in the air conditioning and free Wi-Fi and take a ride. I talked to some airport officials last night that told me that at the end of the night when the route stops and terminates at the airport, that over 24 homeless people every night get dropped off at the airport and basically have nowhere to go. This was just the end of the free ride. The mobile apartment that they were rolling in has come to an end, and it's time to get off, and there they are, right? Right at Tucson's airport, right where we're supposed to welcome tourism, right where we're supposed to welcome business executives coming in to consider building their factories or putting their jobs here in the old Pueblo. Ultimately, these things just can't be free forever. One only needs to look at the city of Kansas City, who just in the last week has decided to dump their free fare system. They were one of the first, right? In March of 2020, they jumped right on the free fare train, and for the last 5 years have been giving away fares. The last 2 years, they've done studies and have determined that they actually need to go back to charging, and they're going to go to a $2 per patron fare starting this week, right now. And this is something that the city of Tucson needs to consider as well, too. They had a bit of a study session on this one and determined that they actually have to do an economic equity study before they can raise these fares as part of federal law right now. But this is something that our city officials absolutely need to look into. It isn't about the cost of recuperating the 58 to $70 million we're going to spend on these buses. I knew that. You knew that we weren't going to get there. But suddenly, ridership won't be as heavy if there's some cost to it. If you even had to produce an ID, like some sort of card for a reduced fare, we would know who was on the bus. So if you started shenanigans, we could suspend your digital ID, or at least somewhere have an annotation of who these people were on the bus. And it would make the bus station safer as well, too. I operate restaurants at River and Campbell, and on the southwest corner of River and Campbell, there's been a homeless encampment living in the bus stop now for about 2 months. This is right in front of Cambridge Shopping Center. This is where Ted Maxwell's office from SALC is. Juan Ziscomani has an office in Cambridge. And right there, because it's located in the city of Tucson, there's literally an encampment built up on this bus stop, visible from the road at River and Campbell. And it's been there for months, because if any time you just ask them to leave, they'll just hop on the bus and go for a quick jaunt, and it will take them right back home when they finished right at the bus stop. And so I'm hoping that the city will listen to this and it will listen to your public commentary and get out there and do the right thing and understand that nothing in life is free. Other news here in Tucson on your food for thought and things you need to know. The University of Arizona has lost enigmatic women's coach, Adia Barnes. She's announced her departure to Southern Methodist University, right? That private Christian money out there is probably pretty strong to draw in coaches like this. And we're stuck holding the bag on a program that has had a huge fan base interest, right? Ever since our national title run in 2021 due to the play of R.A. McDonald. But in recent years, hasn't performed as well as we'd like. U of A insiders tell me that the job was offered to UNLV women's coach, Lindy LaRocque, and she has turned down the University of Arizona. And so we're now staring down the barrel of not having a coach right now of our women's team. And it's going to be the first major hire for our new athletic director, Desiree Reed-Francois, to come out and make a major program coaching hire of her choice. And so this is going to be really interesting for the university on who they pick and how we figure out a way to continue that interest that we had in women's basketball, where suddenly we were selling 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 tickets. We actually had sellouts for like one of those NIT games over there at McHale for a women's game, like super cool. And I don't know how we're going to recapture that magic and get that one back, but that's certainly something for you to keep your eyes on here in the old Pueblo, as that interest in the women's team like could come back, and it's something that I hope we don't lose. And so I'm looking forward to finding out who that new coach is going to be for our women's team. And then finally, for those that are big fans of the men's basketball team, there's another big drop in the news happening this morning at 9:45 a.m. I'll call it the Braden Burries sweepstakes, right? A top-rated combo guard out of California is going to choose his school live on ESPN News at 9:45 this morning. One of the top-rated guards in the entire country that would immediately make the University of Arizona a tremendous competitor and potential national championship, you know, caliber team. We're going to get that drop literally in about 2 hours over here. And so keep an eye on that news this morning. If that one happens, like, hold your horses over here. It's going to be a great run for the University of Arizona. University insiders tell me we are right now in the lead on those five teams that Mr. Burries is going to choose from. The leading two candidates are the University of Arizona and USC. He happens to be a California native. And so we'll find out in about 2 hours from now whether the University of Arizona has won the Braden Burries sweepstakes and will be even more competitive next year. We're going to take a quick break over here. When we come back after the action, I'm going to bring on a local entrepreneur, Mr. Mo Asnani, the owner of D2 and Downtown Dispensaries. They've got some new projects coming up as well, too. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. Lovely April morning this morning here in Tucson. This is one of my favorite times of the year, quite frankly, where it's like a little toasty in the day, but cools off at night. You can still rock those winter jackets for like the last week or two here before summer grabs us with its fiery grip. But one of the things that also happens right around this time in April is a candidate submission date for city council, right? On April 7th was the absolute last day that candidates could submit their signatures if they want to run for city council. Now, that race is, of course, in November, on November 4th, to be exact, on 2025. But we've got a primary on August 5th. And as it turns out, because there's not an awful lot of Republican candidates coming, in one of the wards over here, because we've got races in wards 3, 5, and 6, in ward 5, whoever wins the Democrat primary on August 5th has won. It is pretty much over at that point. And there are four candidates out there for that one. There is Morning Voice veteran Jesse Lugo, Christopher Eldsner, Fabian Danobetia, and Selena Barajas all running for that particular seat. On Ward 3, we've got incumbent Kevin Dahl. He'll be the only incumbent running right now, but he's got a competitor in TUSD candidate Shady Shaw. And then, of course, Janet Wittenbraker as running as a Republican in Ward 3. So there will be a race there in that one. Basically, the Kevin Dahl, Shady Shaw winner would face Janet Wittenbraker in November for that Ward 3 seat. And in Ward 6, there's a crowded field on the Democrat side as well, too. You've got Miranda Schubert, James Sinex, Leighton Rockefeller Jr., and Teresa Riel from the Pima Community College Board as well, all running on the Democrat primary. And the winner of that would take on Jay Tolkoff, a former restaurateur from PJ's T6 filling station located over at 6th in Tucson. I love when restaurateurs get involved in the race over here, right? People always wonder, like, hey, you're you're in business, why are you getting involved in politics? Well, when you're in the business of restaurants, you are in the business of government. There is an awful lot of regulation that goes on with respect to restaurants. You got health department. You've got, you know, the Department of Liquor. You've got the State Department of Health. You've got the various forms of taxation between the city and the county and the state. There's just an awful lot of regulation. So if anybody knows how that sort of work, you know, happens and how that experience goes, it happens to be entrepreneurs and a lot of times restaurants. But if I could think of an industry that's more regulated than restaurants, I've got a guest over here right now, live in the KVOI studios, Mr. Mo Asnani, owner and founder of D2 and Downtown Dispensaries. Good morning, Mo.
Hey, Grant. How you doing? Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for coming in this morning. I understand you got a new project that just opened up in the last couple weeks inside of the city of Tucson.
Yeah, so we did a soft opening for our D2 location on Oracle a few weeks ago. Today is actually a ribbon cutting and a grand opening. So really excited about having our third location in town.
Perfect timing. So you had to do a soft opening in the same way restaurants do, like that kind of like practice run, lining up, figuring out where everything goes?
Yeah. And what we're doing here is pretty ambitious because it's a 10,000 square foot indoor footprint with an attached drive-thru. So really, you know, the drive-thru is not going to be open for another week, couple weeks maybe. But it gives us a logistical, you know, training for our employees.
Very cool. Why don't you break down for our listeners who you are, how you got your start in the dispensary business over here? Because that's a pretty interesting and unique field.
Yeah, so I'm coming up on year number 13 of being in the licensed cannabis industry here in Arizona. You know, I started off basically working on the applications and kind of being a consultant for some folks. But I also realized as that was happening that this could be a really interesting long-term opportunity as the feds potentially change the laws. We're hoping that happens soon. But back then, it was really all about compliance. So that's how I got my start.
And so your first operations were the downtown dispensary, right?
Yeah, we have rebranded it, right, by the way, to D2 now. But yeah, we opened up downtown on 6th and 6th in August of 2013.
Amazing. It's crazy to think that it's already been basically 13 years of legalized cannabis in Arizona, and the laws are still changing. I mean, like, it seems to me like a week-by-week basis, like there are just updates over and over and over again about how all of this works.
Yeah. And I mean, I count it as 13 years because we started in 2012 with so much work, you know, before getting open, obviously. But yeah, there's a tremendous amount of regulation around the industry. But I also think that, you know, we're at an inflection point for where we're going longer term.
So what changes have you seen happen in the last decade in the cannabis industry over here in Pima County, like based on where you started versus where you are today?
Well, when we were medical only, which was basically 2012, you know, on to 2020, recreational really changed the game with people being able to buy if they're 21 or over. And I think what we saw was a massive amount of investment in infrastructure, cultivation, production, as if there was always going to be unlimited demand. And I think what we're seeing now is a bit of a normalizing of pricing and a little more commoditizing. But longer term, I do think, you know, more regulation will change the market dynamic.
So do you think that there's like over or under production right now of cannabis? Is there too much product that's driving the prices down, or have we hit like an equilibrium?
I'll tell you some crazy numbers. So in Arizona, for example, you know, on the wholesale market, a gram of THC distillate goes for $2. In Maryland, it goes for $20. Missouri, it's about $9. In Ohio, it's about $12. So when you look at it, every state in America is basically operating like a different country when it comes to the economic and market structure around their product. So I really do think that we're at a reckoning. And the thing with Arizona is we have a water constraint on the state, yet we are cultivating as if we have infinite water supply. So I do think some more light is being brought on that issue.
It's got to be more expensive ultimately to produce in the state of Arizona, right? Compared to California, where you've got a more temperate climate and more rain and things of that nature.
Yeah, and I think this is honestly a regulatory blind spot, because when I've talked to it about people, they have no idea that, you know, they think cannabis, like I've heard this adage, grows like a weed, doesn't need much water. Actually, it needs a lot of water. you know, the reason it's abundant in the Pacific Northwest is because of their climate and rain, like you just talked about, and conditions that are very favorable.
Sure. You know, when we think of like all the crazy news that's gone on over the last couple of weeks and the tariffs and the changes and product that's produced in the United States or not, I mean, I would assume that, you know, pre sort of state legalization, the grand majority of our product was quote unquote imported, right, from the South. And now we've got a domestic level of production, no?
We do, and I'll tell you what's very interesting. I won't name one of my vendors who's in the hardware business in China, but they're in the process of building a factory in the United States, you know, to do the manufacturing of vape hardware domestically. So it's really interesting to see adaptation across the supply chain for this industry.
But there's still no legalization, right, on a federal level right now for the product in any capacity. These can't cross state lines. You can't open a D3 or D4 dispensary in Maryland, even though the cost is 10x for the product up there, huh?
I mean, you can if you go and get a state license through their process, you know, but no, in terms of every state being its own ecosystem with the local Department of Health Services or some other, you know, state bureau regulating it. In some cases, like in Washington State, it's the Liquor Control Board. Here, it's the Arizona Department of Health Services. So, yeah, you really have a very, like, wide spectrum of regulators depending on where you are.
Awesome. Well, we're going to take a quick break over here. We've got Moaz Nani, owner of the D2 dispensary. He's talking about his new location opening up at Oracle and Roger. They've got a soft opening that's been happening all week, and their grand opening is today. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger and Moaz Nani on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m. Your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. Every weekday, 7 to 9 a.m. on The Morning Voice, we're bringing you live local news and talk. Great content from a great number of hosts. On Mondays, we've got Lydia Aranda. On Tuesdays, we've got Ted Maxwell from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council in his engagement hour. He had a great one yesterday with Juan Siskamani. On Wednesdays, you get myself, Grant Kruger. We're talking local restaurants, politics, and fun things about governmental regulation. On Thursdays, Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. Tomorrow, Tom's got Kristen Sharp from the Greater Oro Valley Chamber of Commerce and Shelby Francom from the El Conquistador Tucson Hilton Resort. All kinds of neat things happening there in Tucson. And on Fridays, Dr. Ed Ackerley bringing you updates from the University of Arizona. We are The Morning Voice. But we've got another segment over here with Moaz Nani. For those that don't know Mo, he's the owner of D2 Dispensaries. Welcome back, Mo.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, so before the break, you were mentioning that you have a drive-through coming up in this new D2. Tell me about drive-through cannabis. How does this work?
So drive-through cannabis has existed in Tucson for almost 2 years. We have drive-through at our location on 22nd and Kolb. That does have extended hours compared to the indoor experience. And then on Oracle and Roger, the drive-through will be ready in about, you know, let's call it by 4:20 is our target date to have it done. So again, we're hoping to have that happen. But really, it's a very cool experience because you have an exhaust system that's first of its kind, you know, where you can get a bunch of cars in an indoor drive-through, and we're able to secure that at night with shutter doors and everything. So it's unique, the build out for that.
So you've got an indoor drive through, kind of like driving into like an automotive service center or something, perhaps? Like,
yeah, exactly. It's very similar to that. And, you know, one of the main things that we thought about when we were doing the indoor drive through was you don't want people getting rained on, or, you know, when you have so much heat like we do in the summer, we at least can have somewhat of a few degrees cooler in there, you know, when you're stacking up cars going back for how long. We want it to be a nice experience. So, yeah, and it's all secure. Everything's on camera. That's the other part for compliance and security. We were able to do all that because it's indoor, and outdoor drive-through makes that harder.
So you referenced 4:20, right? April 20th, like a big date in the cannabis industry. In the same way Cinco de Mayo is a really big date in, say, the Mexican restaurant business. Explain 4:20 to our listeners. Where does that come from?
You know, there's many different thoughts about where 420 started. So I will just say, like, I think that when people looked at the clock and said, hey, it's time to do a certain something, and which, you know, is light up, that's where it started off as a tradition, I think, way back in the day, and has become a legendary folklore type date now.
So is that your biggest date of the year? Is that, like, for the cannabis industry, your New Year's Eve or Cinco de Mayo?
I would say that for us, you know, Black Friday and 420, but 420 is definitely up there. As much as it can be during this part of the year.
We need to rebrand that into Green Friday, perhaps. Maybe that's...
Oh, well, it falls on Sunday. It falls on Easter Sunday this time.
Oh, my goodness. There is an interesting conflict right there for sure. Hey, so speaking of the cannabis industry, this is no longer just flower, right? That we knew it from the 1970s. Can you break down to our listeners the kind of products that you produce over at D2 and what their effects and benefits are?
Yeah, we're definitely in the manufacturing and production business. We produce vertically at our location in Tucson. You know, just so the listeners know, we employ over 160 people, mostly in the production area, and then obviously quite a bit at retail. But we produce over 250 SKUs here in town locally, including edibles, vapes, extracts, topicals. And really the goal is we want to have a multi-format product set for people to say, okay, I don't want to smoke something into my lungs and get high, right? I want to be able to apply a gel and get pain relief, or I want to take an edible and get better sleep at night without feeling some really strong effects. So I think the nuance in the product set is much more diverse than it used to be when we first opened. It was simply like, oh, here's some joints, here's some flower, like, you know, you said back in the day. And now what we have is a very complex consumer packaged goods ecosystem where people can choose, just like when they go to a store. We believe in variety and abundance. And that's why we also have a lot of the bigger brands that are carried, you know, statewide in our stores. But we also believe in controlling the experience ourselves for people who like products like we do. Like, I don't really make anything I don't use, right? Like, when it comes down to it, I enjoy some of our products the most because I was able to control the experience of making it and to do the end result, to be a certain effect.
Now, there are some THC products out there on the market that are not being sold through dispensaries, at least for a short while longer here in the state of Arizona. There seem to be hemp beverages recently for sale that have a small percentage of THC in them. And I saw them even at Total Wine recently.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is something which has been, it's been a hard situation to watch, because in 2018, the federal government allowed for the Farm Bill to have hemp having some percentage of THC on a dry weight basis available. So this was a loophole. And this loophole has kind of gotten exploited to where you have a lot of unlicensed stores selling what are cannabis adjacent products, but they didn't get the THC from the plant itself. They got it from a chemical conversion process, thereby making it, you know, a slightly different product. And what we have now is more unlicensed competitors in the marketplace than licensed competitors. So I really think that matters, because what we do is we also collect a 16% excise tax that goes to public safety, highways, community colleges, infrastructure. And when people do not shop at our stores for cannabis products and go to the alternative market to get these chemically, you know, derived cannabinoids, they're bypassing that ecosystem and they're not getting the benefits of safety testing, third parties, you know, vetting every batch. So I really think that's important for listeners to understand that there's a .gov website where they can go and find all the licensed dispensaries.
And so there's been this huge proliferation of smoke shops in Tucson, something I sort of berate, and I think it's, you know, part of the greater lack of economic development policies that we have in the city of Tucson. But there's over 100 24-hour smoke shops right now in the Old Pueblo, many of which are selling these cannabinoid derivatives, right? Like, can you explain the difference between, like, Delta 8 and Delta 9 and, like, how this is actually legal that they're selling some product in these smoke shops?
I won't say I think it's legal. I don't believe it is. I believe the Attorney General Chris Mays actually put an opinion out last year saying she didn't believe it was. Then on March 24th, she sent a letter saying that enforcement would begin on April 24th, which is coming up pretty soon. So with that backdrop, think of it as this. When you're taking down a hemp plant that mostly has CBD in it because it has not converted to THC yet in whatever stage of harvest, you're then using a bunch of chemical processes and solvents, really, to convert that CBD into THC delta 9, delta 8, delta 10, all these things that we don't know what other, you know, chemicals are produced from that that stay in the product and may go into your system and be ingested that way. And especially in an edible format, I don't need to tell you that that can be potentially dangerous. In fact, you know, there's some pretty sad stories out there. And I think that the reason for that is that people are not making this in a regulated fashion. We're limited 10 milligrams THC per unit by law, right? So if somebody's going and doing a chemical process with something outside of that label and then, you know, doing 10 or 15 times that dosage, that may have some very, very dangerous effects. So we really caution people on going outside of the licensed cannabis ecosystem. There's 180 stores, I think, at this point in Arizona that serve it, that are licensed by the Arizona Department of Health Services. And I can tell you, having been through plenty of inspections with them over the last 13 years, they know what they're doing, they're professionals, and they really are looking out for consumer safety first.
Without a doubt. I to give another analogy to the restaurant business, this would be like the equivalent of being like, well, I don't want to have that Grey Goose vodka. Instead, I'll just have this homemade one made in someone's bathtub in the back corner over here. It's 50% off, and it doesn't have as much taxes, so it's got to be good, right?
Yeah, that's a very good analogy. The bootlegging model is something that kind of died off in the 30s and 40s in the first scale. But yeah.
Hey, great fortunes were made during that bootlegging era as well, too. Well, this is a fascinating conversation. We're going to take a quick break over here. We've got one more segment with Mo Asnani, owner of D2 Dispensaries. When we come back after the break, you're listening to Grant and Mo on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. We've got one more segment with D2 Dispensary owner, Mo Asnani. Welcome back, Mo.
Thank you for having me again.
Hey, thanks for spending part of your Wednesday with us and talking about the industry over here. There's so much regulation and so many changes that have happened. Like, what do you think the future looks like for the cannabis industry in Arizona and even the U.S.? Like, opportunities and threats. Like, there's so much that could happen out there. What's your perspective on this?
I think there's been a fragmentation, you know, across the country, as I was talking about a little bit earlier, with different markets having just like widely different prices by a factor of 5 or 10. And I think longer term, right, if you do have an effective market structure from the federal government, I really think there's an opportunity to say, okay, if you're producing in one state and it's a much lower market, then should you be able to do interstate commerce and potentially have a federal tax on it? That could, you know, I think the Treasury is looking for more ways to fill their coffers right now. So I do believe that there's an opportunity there for regulators to look at this and say that this industry has been in the dark, right? The average analyst thinks that it's worth that we're doing 25 to 30 billion a year, and with projections going out, you know, 5 billion more a year, blah blah. But the simple truth is those numbers don't account for the gray market and the black market that exists, especially with what we were talking about earlier. So it might be double that. And really, when you think about, you know, the real impact of a potentially $50 to $100 billion a year industry being brought into the light with access to small business loans, with access to all the financial infrastructure that is simply not there. We're not even allowed to take credit cards. We weren't allowed to have banking until a few years ago, for the most part. So you really have all this growth happening without the average person being able to invest in it. It doesn't get to be on the NASDAQ or the NYSE, but we let foreign companies be on, you know, our exchanges. So I really think that when you look at this dynamic across the board and say, so much is broken, but to fix it, I don't think it's that hard because of the fact that the federal government has not been involved. And this is a time, I think, to say, okay, when you look at the bigger picture, you know, how does it benefit the overall ecosystem and the economy while creating a safe structure? Remember, 200 million Americans live in the 38 states where cannabis is either federally, is either medically or recreationally legal. So that's a big deal, right? You're talking about the majority of the population, about 66%, having access to this product in some way. So to say, oh, you know, we're going to make this go away, that's not realistic anymore. And I think the more that political parties of all stripes just look at that and say, we are now going to move forward with this and create a structure for it, I do think that's a potential future.
So ultimately, like, this is domestic production too, right, Mo? Like, if we've had, you know, on the news, all these tariffs and whatnot in the alcohol world, there's a lot of things I can't produce in the United States. I can't make tequila in the United States. I can't make mezcal in the U.S. I can't make a French Bordeaux or a champagne in the U.S. But everything that's produced and sold in your dispensaries right now is domestic production, no?
I honestly believe this, having, you know, traveled a little bit and having a good understanding. I think the best cannabis in the world is produced in the United States by far, just because of the amount of infrastructure that goes into indoor cultivation here and the fact that we are still a very capitalist market and we did put in all the infrastructure to have really good products. So yeah, we are very, very good at producing it here in this country and even in the state and county.
And that's a great American thing, right? That ultimately we figured out the ways to grow the technology, the efficiency, the economies of scale to become a world leader in something, right? On a production side of things, there's so many industries that we're no longer producing in the United States. And this is one that we could have a stranglehold on.
Not only that, we have the largest genetic bank of cannabis in the United States with all the different strains that are here. And there's demand from other countries to actually import cannabis if we did have, you know, export and regulatory controls around that. So I think that we really have so much opportunity. And the threat, the biggest threat, is political will. So hopefully we get a little bit more of that.
But we'll have to work together as a team and see what we can do to help fix that one over here. We've only got a minute left. Give our listeners a breakdown of where they can find you and interact with D2 Dispensaries.
So D2 Dispensaries, our flagship location is on the east side at 22nd and Kolb. Our new location is at Oracle and Roger. And our legacy location, which has been a part of the community for the longest time, is at 6th and 6th. Our website is d2now.com. And we have an app where you can get your loyalty points, all that stuff. But really, the main thing I want people to remember is don't think of cannabis as a smokable-only product. The amount of innovation and effort we put into making sure that you're getting the best experience through vapes, edibles, extracts, all locally here in town, where you scan a QR code and you can tell where every ingredient is coming from that is cannabis-based in it. I really can't emphasize how much effort we put into compliance.
Amazing. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday with us. Mo Asnani, owner of D2 Dispensaries. Their grand opening is today on Oracle and Roger, so go swing by and take a peek at that one. We've got another hour of The Morning Voice coming up after the break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger on 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Hour two of The Voice. We're talking neat things about the restaurant industry in Southern Arizona. Our season is still kicking right now. It goes all the way till about the end of May, right? Mother's Day, U of A graduation, high school graduations, and right about that time is where it tightens up over there. You get to about Memorial Day weekend, and that's the exodus out of Tucson. That is our summer, so there are some pretty hot and heavy weeks coming up. This is still the meat of our restaurant season. As such, we've got a lot more opening news rather than closing news, which I'm always happy to report. Trust me, I love talking about new, great establishments opening up in the old Pueblo, ways that we can improve upon our best Mexican food in America, ways that we can improve upon the City of Gastronomy Awards that we've gotten. We've got award-winning restaurants here in Southern Arizona, and we've got some new concepts coming up to report. Months ago, I brought you news that the Roadhouse Cinemas was building a big entertainment complex at Swan and Grant, right, in the Crossroads Festival area, and this is called Roadies. Roadies is open this week. They are doing their soft opening. Just like Mo talked about a little bit on the previous segment for the soft opening for his dispensaries, restaurants absolutely need a soft opening. It is not easy. And it's very difficult because when you open up for the first time, you just don't know where everything is. You think you know. You've laid out the restaurant. You've got what they call the mise en place, the space where the chef has, you know, each of their little cubbies for their ingredients. And you think you know what's going to sell and when you're going to be busy and how you should staff. But you don't really know. And so soft openings are a great way to invite in friends and family, often at, but not always, at a discounted price, and let the restaurant have a run of it and start to figure things out. I remember my soft opening at Union Public House. It was my first one-star Yelp review pretty much ever. Our soft opening had a free night where literally everything was free. And at the beginning of the show, we talked about when everything is free, it has no value, right? So instantly my soft opening, because I didn't know any better at the time, became a giant steak fest, right? Everybody wanted the $30 New York strip at that point because it was free. The kitchen backed up, right? And suddenly ticket times crested to 30 minutes, 35, 40 minutes long, and there were unhappy guests. But this was my soft opening. Everything was free, and I still got a one-star Yelp on that one for a free meal, for a free steak. And so it happens. Be patient with some of these new restaurants when they open up over here. Roadie should have great crowds. It's a neat entertainment complex. It's got games. It's got bowling. It's got axe throwing, right? You think about mixing alcohol and axe throwing over there already, and gives me a little bit of pause, but I'm sure they've got some safety procedures and an amazing insurance contract to make that one happen. So go check out Roadies. Their soft opening is this week. Their grand opening is next week. It's a local Tucson company as well, too, with two other locations, one in Scottsdale and one in Colorado Springs, wishing them a tremendous amount of success. As well, the He Me Coffee Shop, located on Congress downtown, has announced they're opening up a second location. They've leased 2,800 square feet at 800 East University. Think the Marshall Foundation locations on the south side of University over there. A lot of turnover in those spots, for sure. That's a tough, tough location because once season breaks at the end of May, things lighten up quite a bit on University Boulevard. But they're opening their second spot on University over here. And their choice of locations, one downtown and one university, leads me to a topic we've been discussing for months on this show, and that could be the decline of Fourth Avenue a bit. So many people are bypassing Fourth Avenue on the modern streetcar as sort of just a in-between destination between downtown and University. The rise of University Boulevard with the big clubs there, the Gentle Bends, and we've had Rich Pfeiffer on this show, the Illegal Pete's, the Frog and Firkins, the No Anchovies, right? Like, these are big monster restaurants that turn into nightclubs at night. And they've got big, cool patios. Downtown has got some new build-outs and some cool new restaurants, and Rio Nuevo, of course, comes in and helps fund some of those. But Fourth Avenue doesn't. It's got a lot of older locations, legacy locations, right? Fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, 10th generation stores. And they don't have as cool of patios and decks and things as some of these newer buildouts, nor can they because of the historic nature of their buildings. And we've seen some closures, right? Between Blush and between Hermanos recently that were like cool spaces in general with decent buildouts, seasoned operators, and they didn't make it on the avenue over there. And Hemi picking this university location kind of shows where those two now epicenters are of college student business, and that happens to be University Boulevard and downtown, and they are just passing Fourth Avenue on the streetcar as they roll by. Speaking of downtown, Katsu House is opening up in the Brick Box Brewery location. They've had food in a couple different spots. Brick Box was, of course, the former Thunder Canyon Brewery. And so they're bringing in a Katsu chicken and steak concept called Katsu House, opening up this week as well, too. So go check those ones out. Moho is opening up an addition to their restaurant. This is the Cuban restaurant, Campbell and Grant on the northeast corner. They're opening up a little addition to their place called La Ventanilla, which means little window in Spanish. And that opens up at 7:30 in the morning. And so they're doing some coffee and some Cuban breakfast favorites out of that and sort of a pickup concept. So sort of a neat thing to see that one. So I'm going to go check that one out. That one just opened up this week. So do check out Moho for that one. And then unfortunately, on the closing side of things, Ham Bones Restaurant, CJ Ham's Southern Meat and Three concept, announced abruptly its closing after about a six-month run over here. Another sad example where you've got a seasoned restaurateur that's done some great things at Saguaro Corners and done some great things in his culinary history and just didn't make it over here in the old Pueblo and inside of the first 6 months as well, too. This happens a lot in this business, unfortunately. It is a tough world out there, and if you don't open up with some degree of bankroll to keep you going and those first few months go cash flow negative because, oh, let's say you didn't understand how to staff because you didn't know which hours you were going to be busy, it's very easy to run inefficiently and run negatively for a number of months when you first open. And if you can't get out of that cycle, it can end pretty badly. And unfortunately, CJ announced the closing of Hambones. I was really, really sad to see that one go down so quickly because he's a great guy and a great operator. And I know he's going to land somewhere cool as well, too. Speaking of other neat things going on in the Old Pueblo from a culinary perspective, Argentina Heart and Soul is this weekend at Hacienda del Sol. If you have never had a chance to experience this particular food, wine, and music festival, it's a pretty neat thing. It's 6 to 9 p.m. They've got a really amazing Argentinian buffet. They're pairing it with wine tastings from Argentinian wines, a lot of live music going on. I've had a lot of staff members of mine that have worked at Hacienda del Sol, Union Hospitality and Hacienda right next to each other. And not shockingly, we share, you know, a commonality of employees, and they've always spoke very highly of this event and how cool it is and one of the busier days of the year for Hacienda, and a neat way to go check that one out in some capacity. So that is at the Hacienda del Sol Guest Ranch Resort this Sunday, April 9th, 6 to 9 p.m. Tickets are $100 a piece. So it's not cheap, but it's pretty good. And that includes, again, and, you know, your adult beverages, it includes the live entertainment, includes an Argentinian buffet, all really cool things happening here in the Old Pueblo. As we get into our season over here finishing up, be careful of the weeks leading up to Cinco de Mayo, Mother's Day, and graduation. If establishments take reservations, I actually suggest you look into those reservations right now, like literally this week. Nobody wants to plan anything a week or a month in advance in the Old Pueblo, but legitimately, this is something you have to do, because that time of year, particularly that Mother's Day graduation weekend, is about the busiest weekend of the entire calendar year. And every year I have large groups and families show up incredibly upset that there are tremendous waits for tables during this time. But I'm telling you, the places that take reservations, like, jump on that one now. It's my little nugget and tip for advice for you on this one, that week, like, you know, from May 5th to about the 13th or so is on. That is the highest of high seasons in Tucson. Get out there, make those rezos if you can do it. Book if you could find a private dining room. I would be surprised at this point, because they're all booked with high school graduation, well, college graduations from the U of A. And then the weekend after, we get high school graduations as well, too. I'm always a little more excited by the college graduations, because there's a lot more expenditure from our guests over there. Mom and dad are coming from out of state, celebrating the fact that they don't have a $40,000 a year out of state tuition, room and board, is a cause for celebration. And generally, they're ordering the good stuff, right? We're on the high school graduation side, and I've got a daughter graduating from Catalina Foothills High School, you know, this spring as well, too. The high school dads and moms are looking at staring down the barrel of a $40,000 a year expenditure. They're at the beginning of the parabolic curve of the college experience, and it's not quite the same thing, but both those weeks are absolute movers and shakers, and so do get out there and make those rezos and make that happen. When we come back after the break, we're going to bring on a famous, well-known restaurateur and the chief operating officer of Kodak Health. I've got John Aldecoa and Christine Welter-Hall coming up. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger on 1030 AM. The Voice, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger, and we are joined live in the KVUI studios by Christine Welter-Hall and John Aldecoa. Christine is the Chief Operating Officer of Kodak Health Recovery and Wellness and the coordinator for the Dine Out Safety event happening this upcoming Wednesday. And John, you may know from the KVUI studios, is the owner of Brother John's Bourbon at Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue. Welcome to the KVUI studios, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in. Can you tell us a little bit about the Southern Arizona Center Against Sexual Assault to get us started?
Yeah, absolutely. The Southern Arizona Center Against Sexual Assault, or SACASA, as you will often hear it called, is the largest provider of sexual assault services in the state of Arizona. We're part of Kodak Health Recovery and Wellness, which is a local not-for-profit organization here. And SACASA has been around since 1973. So wow. quite a while. And we help victims of sexual violence and their loved ones through a full continuum of services that are based on their individual needs.
Wow, that's amazing. And John, break down a little bit about yourself here for a second.
Oh, well, I own Brother John's Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue with my brother. So we got Brother John's, right? Dave and John.
Oh, we're missing you on the mic over there, okay. John. Give it 1 second. Brendan's going to hook us up over
I
here.
I can actually tell you.
Go for it, John. I think I got you now.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
All right. I'm John Aldecoa. My brother and I are partners at Brother John's Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue. So that's how we get the Brother John's. I'm not that devout or, you know, to be that kind of brother. But yeah.
We keep it secular over there at Brother John's.
So we've been around about 10 years now. So Tucson natives, and we just love Tucson.
So how did you get involved with all of this over here with Kodak and with Sakasa?
Well, we got invited when we first opened to participate, and we've pretty much participated every year that we could. And I also have a lot of friends that work at Kodak, as well as my wife's a therapist. I don't even think you knew that.
I did not know that.
No, so she's been working in that area, working with family and children and those type of issues her whole career. So I've always been closely tied to Kodak and all the other nonprofits here in town in regards to helping the community.
Amazing. Well, this sounds like a very great nonprofit over here. I was looking at the statistics surrounding sexual violence and some of these statistics that come from RAIN, which is the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, say that every 68 seconds an American is sexually assaulted. In the course of this interview, that could be almost 9 people or maybe more. Mm-hmm. That 1 in 6 women and 1 in 33 men have been the victim of attempted or completed rape in their lifetime. That's staggering.
It absolutely is. And what we also know is that the amount of sexual assaults reported is very low compared to the amounts that actually occur. So while we're saying that we know that 1 in 6 women has been the victim of attempted or completed rape in their lifetime, it's probably actually much higher than that. And that's why Sakasa services are so important. We offer 24-hour sexual assault crisis line in English and Spanish, so that anytime someone, usually it's folks calling who have been triggered by something that relates to an assault that occurred in their past. So they're calling to need some support in the moment. But often we'll also get calls from folks who have just been raped, or they're a loved one of someone who has just been raped and want to know what to do. And so what they can do is call Sakasa, which they've done in those times. But in addition to that hotline, we also have 24/7 crisis intervention, advocacy, information, and referral services. So we have advocates that go to the hospitals every day of the week, every hour of the day, to meet with survivors and help them feel heard, feel supported, understand that what their rights are as a victim of crime. And then we also have medical forensic examiners who, if the survivor wants, will provide the comprehensive and compassionate medical forensic exam. Most listeners would probably know that as a rape kit, but it is a lot more than just collecting the forensic evidence. It's also checking the entire body for injuries, helping prescribe medications to treat those injuries, prophylaxis for potential STIs or pregnancies as well that may have been caused by the assault. So, and then ongoing follow-up medical care too. So then after that initial crisis for someone, we also offer therapy for individuals, couples, and families, no matter when the assault might have occurred. So this assault could have occurred for someone when they were 5 years old, and now here they are 35 and really being impacted by that trauma. We're here for you. The assault could have occurred last week, and we're here for you too. With our services. And these services are all available at no cost to survivors, in large part because of grants, contracts with local organizations, and because of fundraising and individual philanthropy.
So speaking of awareness, I see that April is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and you guys are putting on a day-long event to raise awareness about sexual assault called Dine Out for Safety. Tell us more about Dine Out for Safety. It sounds like a great day of fundraising over here.
Yeah, it is an absolutely fabulous citywide event, quote unquote, but really it's a citywide experience. As John mentioned, Brother John's has been participating for 10 years, which is actually when I started 10 years ago. Also, I started coordinating this event, but Dine Out for Safety is in its 26th year of occurring in our community. And this year, 1 week from today, Wednesday, April 16th, 23 locally owned restaurants all on that one day will be donating up to 20% of proceeds from all purchases to support survivors at the Southern Arizona Center Against Sexual Assault.
That's so cool. Where do I find out about this? Do you have a website in some capacity?
Of course we do. It's simple. Just go to dineoutforsafety.org. You can see all of the 23 participating restaurants, what meals they're open for, what percentages they're donating, and a lot more that we'll continue to talk about here.
That's so cool. John, so Brother John's Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue has been one of the participating restaurants for years now. What does supporting sexual assault survivors mean to you and your restaurant?
Well, it's real important to us just for the awareness and also, you know, to have people know that there's support out there. And, you know, like I said, my wife being a therapist and working with children and women especially, it's just something close to home for us, and that we want to make sure that our customers and our employees are safe and comfortable. And the restaurant business, you're kind of dealing with, some contributors, with serving alcohol and stuff like that. So creating a safe environment where we know that we're standing up for each other and we're there for each other, that's just kind of, what we want to participate here in town.
Without a doubt. I mean, restaurant business is young, attractive employees working late at night, mix in a bunch of alcohol over here as well, too. And you've got a recipe, for some potential disasters if you don't mitigate this and put safety first. What message would you like to convey to other restaurants and bars about this?
Well, I think awareness is the key part, just being aware and being vocal. And what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. I think that's really important for us as people, and then we take that into our business as well. But, really just to really bring awareness to the community and to your employees and what's out there for them.
So we know that Brother John's is one of the participating restaurants, but there are 22 others beyond this. Tell us a little bit about those ones.
Yeah, such a great lineup. Again, you can see them all at dineoutforsafety.org. This year, for the first time, we have Bate Puerto Rican Gastronomy. Of course, Brother John's. Cafe 54 downtown, which supports individuals with mental illness, is donating 100% of proceeds from their lunch that day. Caps and Corks, and of course their new venue at the Broadway Beer and Wine Bar, all of the Cicharo restaurants, every single one of them. So head out there. Feast is also a longstanding partner. Doug is so supportive. And speaking of reservations that you talked about earlier, be sure to get in on your reservations at all of these. We are 1 week away, folks. Gourmet Girls Gluten-Free Bakery and Bistro, JoJo's Restaurant, Mama Luisa's Italian Restaurant, get that homemade pasta. A new one this year, Midtown Vegan Deli and Market. So another vegan option for us in addition to Charo Vita. Let's see, Noble Hops, get the beers, get the views, get the grub. Riley Craft Pizza and Drink has been participating for many years. Solid options for dinner downtown. Transplant Pizza and Craft, Modern Drinkery, Vero Amore Swan, and newly renamed Amore and Dove Mountain, and then last but not least, Yellow Brick Coffee.
Amazing. So many participants for Dine Out for Safety over here. We've got to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're going to come back with another segment with Christine Welter-Hall, Chief Operating Officer of Kodak Health Recovery and Wellness, and John Aldecoa, owner of Brother John's Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue. You're listening to Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m. Your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. One of my favorite things about being on the radio here every week is that we get to talk all things local, Tucson, 520 related, right? There are so few places that you can go get that sort of content. KVOI happens to be one of them. The Morning Voice comes to you every weekday, 7 to 9 a.m. On Mondays, Lydia Aranda hosts. On Tuesdays, Ted Maxwell from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council. On Wednesdays, you got to deal with me. We're talking restaurants and politics and that unholy intersection of both of them. Thursdays, Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. And on Fridays, Dr. Ed Ackerley, bringing you all kinds of news from the University of Arizona. Now, one of the neat things that is going on this upcoming week, a week from today, is an event called Dine Out for Safety. And we've got another segment with Christine Welter-Hall, the Chief Operating Officer of Kodak Health Recovery and Wellness, and John Aldecoa, the owner of Brother John's Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue. Welcome back, guys.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
So before the break, Christine, you were going over all the restaurants that are participating in this. This is a pretty lofty group over here. And they've chosen to give a percentage of their sales to your cause, right?
That's right. 23 locally owned restaurants participating next Wednesday, April 16th for Dine Out for Safety. When for all the meals that those restaurants are open for, they are donating most of them up to 20% of proceeds. And even Cafe 54 downtown is donating 100% of proceeds from that day from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. to support survivors of sexual violence at the Southern Arizona Center Against Sexual Assault.
Very cool. And our listeners can find out on that website. Like, where do you go see that list again?
Yeah, go to dineoutforsafety.org to see the full list of participating restaurants. We recommend that you dine out for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We have some diehard Dine Out for Safety supporters who literally do every meal of the day just to show their support. Not only is it showing their support by being a patron, and I love this event because our local food scene, we have such diehard supporters of our local restaurants, and that just goes hand in hand oftentimes with people who really care about important social issues as well. And so this is a good marrying of those two kind of topics.
Without a doubt, we've got such an amazing food scene here in Southern Arizona. Mm-hmm. And you've got a great list of restaurants participating on this one and a whole lot of choices, quite frankly, for diners to go out and support. Now, is there any extra cost to the diners for this? How does that work?
Not at all. It's not like a gala where you have to buy tickets and get a fancy dress, get your hair done. This is a simple, low barrier event. We have all different kinds of restaurants with different price points so that people from across the county can choose a restaurant to dine out. They're simply paying for the cost of their meal that, or their coffee or their beer or their wine that they would have that day. And that shows their solidarity with survivors of sexual assault and their support as well.
And so this event's been going on for decades now, you're saying, right?
Yes, this is the 26th year. And actually, it would have been something like the 29th year, but we took some time off during that COVID period. So yeah, it's the 26th year we've put on the event.
So there are some really staggering statistics about sexual assault and how everybody reacts, you know, differently to trauma over here. But how can we as friends and family offer support to survivors as well, too?
Great question. Thanks for asking. Yeah, with the statistics of 1 in 6 women having experienced an attempted or completed rape in their lifetime, 1 in 33 men, we are bound to know someone who sexual violence has occurred with or to. And the best thing that we as loved ones can do is believe survivors and support them and let them tell us without us judging them, saying things that we don't even intentionally realize we're saying, such as, well, were you drinking? Doesn't matter if they were drinking. What were you wearing? Doesn't matter what they were wearing. Nobody should have done this to them. It is not the survivor's fault. We have a society where often victims get blamed. So the best and first thing that someone can do is just listen and support and not judge. The second thing that we can do is make sure that the survivor knows that they're in control of what's next. With sexual assault, control has been taken from someone. Someone else jumped in and said, I don't care if you say no to me, I'm going to do what I want with you. And so all their control was taken. And that is extremely violating. So when someone's healing from that trauma, we want them to know they have all of the control of what decisions they're making. Do they want to report to law enforcement? That's up to them. Do they want to tell anyone? That's up to them. Do they want to get medical help? Completely up to them. We may have our own ideas of what would be good for their healing, but ultimately it's the survivor's choice. So we can educate ourselves about what services are available by going to sacasa.org. That's sacasa.org. Learn about what services are available and present those as options to our loved ones.
That's amazing, Christine. Looking at the numbers over here, it says that 7 in 10 rapes are committed by someone that the victim knows, and that number increases to 9 of 10 when you get into childhood sexual abuse. So this doesn't sound like often like the case of a, you know, a rapist, a sexual assaultant attacking the jogger in the bushes somewhere, you know, in Central Park. This is a situation that occurs far more often in situations where you actually know the assaultant.
That's right. That's right. And that is surprising. It was surprising to me. It's surprising for a lot of people. But I think it's so important to understand what consent is and when consent can and cannot be freely given. So oftentimes we, like I was saying, we talk about what could the woman, for example, have done to prevent that. But really, we want to talk about anyone who might be a perpetrator. It's not always men. Sometimes women can sexually assault others as well. So we want to make sure they know that consent, you need to get consent before progressing sexually. And it's often in those already intimate partner situations or with someone that you know that those boundaries are crossed.
Without a doubt, disturbing facts indeed for this one. And I salute you for taking the time to come on today and to talk to us about this event and for all your work at Kodak as well, too.
Thanks.
It's pretty amazing what you guys do over here. And John, pretty amazing what you guys do over there, too, on Brother John's, not just for participating in this event, but just in general, like to have stuck it out this long in the restaurant business in a big location. You guys are growing as well, too. Understand you've got some catering operations and some event venues and whatnot. Can you stick around for one more segment and we can talk a little bit about your business success over there at Brother John's as well, too?
We'd love to, Grant. Thanks.
Yeah, we'd love to. We're going to take a quick break over here from the action, but we've got one more segment with Christine Welterhall, Chief Operating Officer of Kodak Health Recovery and Wellness, and John Aldecoa, owner of Brother John's Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue. Don't go anywhere.
It's 8:49 with a look at your local traffic. I'm Brennan Kraft on 1030 The Voice. We have a traffic hazard on Wilmot and Golf Links. An accident on Alvernon just south of 22nd Street. A traffic incident reported on Cortero and Silverbell. And a look at your freeways. We have a crash on I-10 going westbound near the Sonoyta Ranch area. And we have some slowing going eastbound on I-10 between Twin Peaks and Sunset Road. Tucson weather, we have a high today of 93 degrees under clear skies and an overnight low of 57. We've got high near 95 tomorrow and 99, but possibly 100 degrees on Friday. Currently, it's 70 degrees. And now I'm back to the Morning Voice with Grant Krueger.
Welcome back to the Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Krueger, and we've got one more segment with Christine Welterhall, Chief Operating Officer of Kodak Health Recovery and Wellness, and my man, John Aldecoa, owner of Brother John's Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue. Brother John, what's new going on in the Brother John's front over here?
Oh, we got a brand new catering operation where we got a mansion downtown, the Ruby House that we're managing, that we're doing events there, weddings and stuff like that, as well as the Crystal Classics Courtyard where we're managing all the events there as well, plus our own on-site space. So
you've got a fair bit of event space in Brother John's.
Correct.
As well, too. And for those that don't know, Brother John's is located at 1801 North Stone Avenue, the site of the former Wildcat House, right?
A lot of remnants still there in the building. You can look at the original bar top from 1973 is still there.
Which is pretty cool. Imagine if that bar top could tell stories, you know?
I can either confirm or deny anything that happened.
if that bar top could tell stories, I'd probably have to step down from this radio show, sir. So you've got live music going on there as well, too. You do a lot of events, right? Like Friday, yeah. Zona Libre. Tell me a little bit about what you got going on
every
with live
Friday
music.
Night, we got salsa music, live band, a big 9-piece band there every Friday night. And Saturday night, we do different type of music. Different Saturdays, they have different events there. And then we do Sunday jazz every Sunday.
Oh, very cool. Is that with the Tucson Jazz Society?
Next Sunday is our 9-year anniversary of doing live jazz at Brother John's with the Tucson Jazz Society. So, yeah.
Very cool. I love some smooth jazz on Sundays. That's a perfect day for it as well.
well,
Sunday
too.
Fun day, right?
You got any other new plans coming up for expansion or anything like that beyond the event centers over here? It sounds like you've already done a bunch of expansion.
Yeah, I'm just trying to settle in there and, you know, really focusing on our offerings for the different food options. We know in addition to the barbecue, we also have a fancy Mexican menu as well as Italian and, you know, American fanfare. So.
Are you guys still doing all the caterings for the U of A, like the tailgates and that sort of stuff?
We're still under contract with U of A for the football tailgate there. We have our, you know, barbecue truck out there for all the home games and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, we're still doing that and, you know, do lots of caterings, lots of stuff around town. So
I saw the U of A was trying to do tailgates for the basketball team as well, too.
Well, it's not a tailgate, but, yeah, they're trying to just make the fan experience, you know, more, you know, celebratory with the space and the celebration of the team. So it's good times.
Well, hopefully we'll be celebrating this morning at 9:45. I think we get the announcement from Braden Burries, a star point guard out of California, and his selection between the U of A. I see you've got a U of A shirt on over here right now, and USC. And so we're all hoping eagerly with bated breath watching ESPN about an hour from now to see if U of A gets that guy.
You are right on point there. Yep, literally.
Well, I appreciate your support of both, you know, the U of A and the restaurant industry in general. I mean, to have taken such a hallowed location and to have built it out the way you have and been successful the way you have, that's nothing to shake a stick at. That is not easy, my friend.
Just trying to keep up with you, Grant. Just trying to keep up with you.
Lots of caffeine necessary there. Lots of caffeine.
There's room for everyone.
Yes. And I appreciate you, you know, coming on today on Wednesday to take time out of your busy schedule and support Sakasa over here, supporting this Dine Out for Safety event as well, too.
Yeah, it's a great event. And one thing, I know we haven't talked about it yet, but the volunteers come out to the restaurants, and it's just a real festive way to interact with, you know, the organization, with Sakasa and Kodak, and an opportunity actually to buy raffle tickets and all kinds of really cool stuff like that. So it's a heavy topic, but it's a really light event.
Yeah, thanks, John, for saying that. We do. We have over 130 volunteers at all of the restaurants throughout the day, just going around to the tables and thanking the patrons for coming. It's an easy time for us to say, hey, in case you didn't know, these services are available. Just to say, you know, you or someone you might know might need them at some point. And then enjoy your food. And oh, by the way, we're selling raffle tickets for $10 each for over 55 amazing raffle prizes, including the grand prize, which is a $50 gift card to every single one of the 23 participating restaurants. So just come on out. If you can't come out, you can buy raffle tickets online at dineoutforsafety.org, and we'll make sure they get into the pile, and hopefully you can win one of those more than 55 prizes that we've gathered for
you. That's an awful lot of prizes, right? 23 restaurants, a $50 gift card from everyone over there.
That's $1,000 there.
Yeah, right? I'm no math major, but that's a G, right?
$1,150 value. Yeah.
So one more time, the website as well, too, for
dineoutforsafety.org.
Amazing. And John, break it down for our listeners where they can find you.
1801 North Stone Avenue, like you said, and it's BrotherJohnsBBQ.com. And you can also go to BrotherJohnsBBQ on Facebook as well. And I believe that's also our Instagram post as well, BrotherJohnsBBQ.
Amazing. Looking forward to trying some of that barbecue over there. And looking forward to seeing, like, all of you listeners out there for Dine-In for Safety at any of these 23 participating restaurants. I think it's an absolute great cause. And it's really awesome that you took the time out of your day to come on Wednesday and discuss this one with us, too, and our listeners.
It's my honor. We just want everyone to know we're here and available. And we want survivors to know that they are supported and that they are not alone.
I love it. Those are great closing words. A wonderful Wednesday talk with Christine Welter-Hall, Chief Operating Officer of Kodak Health Recovery and Wellness, and Mr. John L. Dakoa, the dynamic owner of Brother John's Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue. It's been my pleasure to spend this part of your Wednesday commute with you. Looking forward to this great Tucson weather and looking forward to seeing you out at all these great participating local Tucson restaurants. Thank you for listening to 10:30 a.m. The Voice, your home for local news and talk.